The Blessed Hope, and tonight we're going to look at the Olivet Discourse, which is in starts in Matthew 24. And our key verses again are Titus 2, 12 and 13. And that just says that we should live looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. And then in 1 John chapter 3, verses 2 and 3, it says, "Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when He is revealed, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. And everyone who has this hope in Him purifies himself just as He is pure." And the reason I've got all of those personal pronouns in bold is just to remind us that we're, again, just to say it one more time, that we're talking about a person here. It's not an event that we're looking for, but it's the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. He is the blessed hope. Now, I want us to review just a few things, just as we're getting started, before we get into Matthew 24. And the first thing we want to just remind ourselves, there were two major questions in this study that we wanted to answer. The first one was this: when will the return of Jesus be in relationship to the millennium? And the second one is, when will the return of Jesus be in relationship to the great tribulation? So those are our two major questions. And we've been looking at those over the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, the millennium. Last week, the great tribulation. And I want to just remind you again that the Bible speaks very specifically about a period of great tribulation. And it says that it will last 42 months. 1,260 days, which in the Jewish calendar, all the months are 30 days. And so if you do 1,260 days, that comes out to 42 months. We see that again in Revelation 12:6, 1,260 days. Revelation 13:5, 42 months. And then in the book of Daniel, it has that prophetic language where it talks about a time, times, and a half time. Well, if you add that up, a time being one, times being two, and then the half time, that's three and a half. So that would be the equivalent of 3.5 years, 42 months, or 1,260 days. And so all speaking about the time of the great tribulation. Now, when it comes to the tribulation and the rapture, we've said that there are three views. The pre-tribulation view. And this is just sort of a general definition of the pre-tribulation view. The rapture, which is spoken of in 1 Thessalonians 4, will take place prior to the tribulation. Those raptured will be taken off the earth. This is what those who hold this view believe. Those raptured will be taken off the earth and kept safe during this time of tribulation. And then a note: for those who hold this view, the rapture and the return of Christ are separate events. Now, for most of us, this is what we were taught growing up. I mean, that's from my earliest days where I could understand anything about the rapture. It was an escape. It was an escape from the tribulation. God was going to spare us from having to go through the tribulation. There would be the two aspects, the rapture and then later the return of Christ being separate events. And so the pre-tribulation view, Southern Baptist in the 20th century, that became the predominant view. And by the time you got to the latter part of the 20th century, that was the only game in town, was the pre-tribulation view. You just some churches even had it in their articles of belief. You had to believe it. If you didn't believe in the pre-tribulation rapture, you couldn't be a part of that church. A lot of independent Baptist churches, that's all they would accept, is the pre-tribulation view. The other two views, you've got the post-tribulation view, and that's where the rapture will bring the great tribulation to a conclusion. Christ will raise the dead saints to life. They will be caught up along with the saints who are alive at that time to meet Him in the air. I have the word "meet" highlighted there because in my understanding, we're going out to meet Him as He's coming back to earth. And we'll come back immediately to earth. And this will take place, as it says there, as He returns to earth to destroy the Antichrist and to set up his literal 1,000-year kingdom on earth. And so that's the post-tribulation view. That happens to be where I've come to in my understanding of it. I believe that that is the correct view. There's all kinds of models of that, though, and there's some that I don't agree with, some of the things that some people in their post-tribulation view espouse. Then you have the mid-tribulation view, and that's where the rapture will take place in the middle of a 7-year period of tribulation, just prior to the 3.5-year period of great tribulation. They believe that the Bible teaches there will be a 7-year period of tribulation, and in the middle of that is when the rapture will take place. Those raptures will be taken off the earth and kept safe during this time of tribulation. And again, the note here is that for those who hold this view, the rapture and the return of Christ are separate events. The rapture occurring in the middle of the tribulation, the return of Christ at the end of the great tribulation. Now, I've got a chart that I've put together, and you probably can't see that up there, but you have it in front of you. And I just wanted to go over it because it kind of summarizes everything that we've talked about for the last 3 weeks. It's all summarized in this chart. And you have the three columns there, the millennium. How is the rapture related to the millennium? How is the rapture related to the great tribulation? Then the adherence to those. I've got the list of some names of people in that third column who that's what they believe is related. And so you see the premillennial view and the postmillennial view and the amillennial view, the three views of how the rapture is related to the millennium. But then if you look under the premillennial view, there's three subcategories, I guess you would say, of how it's related to the Great Tribulation. And that's the pre-trib view, the post-trib view, which is in green there, and then the mid-trib view. Now, the pre-tribulation view has another name that you might run into, big long name there, dispensational premillennialism. You might see that when you're reading in a commentary or something. They're talking about the pre-trib view, if you see that. And the definition there is that the rapture, spoken of in 1 Thessalonians 4, will take place prior to the tribulation. The post-tribulation view, post-trib view, is also called historic premillennialism. And the reason it's called that is because from the earliest days of the church fathers, this is what the church believed for the most part. And then the mid-tribulation view is also sometimes called the pre-wrath view. And then under the post-millennial view in the left-hand column, if you look, you just have a description of what they believe about the Great Tribulation. And it says there they do not believe in a future time of tribulation. And there are several categories of this view. That preterist, it's called, which just means they believe that everything is in the past, or partial preterists. They believe that everything in the Bible that we consider prophecy, except for the last few chapters of Revelation, are not in the past, but everything else is. Those are the partial preterists. And then there's a group that came about right at the end of the 20th century. They're called Christian Reconstructionists. And they are out. Their whole mission is to make the world better through Christianity. And they are post-millennial in their view. They believe it's up to them to make the world better so Christ can come back is really basically what they believe. And then the amillennial view just simply means that they don't take the 1,000-year reign of Christ literally. They think it's symbolic. They do not believe in a future time of tribulation. And the preterist and partial preterist are also included in the amillennial view. And then if you look at the adherence, something that's interesting to me is what a diversity there are of people here that we would say are good Bible teachers and Bible scholars. If you look under the pre-tribulation view, you've got people that we know very well, John MacArthur, Steve Lawson, some of these other names that are listed here. John Darby was the one who was the original person back in about 1830. He began to espouse that view, and it caught on. It got into the Scofield Bible and eventually just spread like wildfire in the 20th century, as we've talked about. And then under the post-trib view, you see these people that are listed here. You've got people like John Gill, Charles Spurgeon, In the 20th century, the main proponent of this view is a man named George Ladd. He wrote a number of books about the post-tribulation view that are really good. But there you've got Charles Spurgeon, who believes in the post-trib view. You've got John MacArthur, Steve Lawson. These are all men that we know are great Bible scholars and Bible teachers. And then if you look down under the, I don't really know too much about any of these men. A little bit about Marvin Rosenthal, who's in the mid-trib view. He's written a lot about the mid-trib view. It really began to catch hold right at the end of the 20th century. It's not, it's probably got fewer adherents than any of them. And then if you look at the post-millennial view, look at Jonathan Edwards shows up in that group. So that was what he taught. R.C. Sproul is predominantly post-millennial. He kind of bleeds over a little bit into amillennialism sometimes, some of the things that he says, but he's primarily post-millennial. And then under the amillennial view, you have Augustine, or Augustine is probably the correct way to say it. And most of the reformers, the people that were involved in the Reformation, they were amillennial. And so I just want to say again, I've said it a couple of times already, but just to say it again, I don't consider this to be a topic that I can be absolutely dogmatic about. It's just impossible to be absolutely dogmatic about this. There are things, even though my view is the post-millennial view, I mean the post-trib view, it is, there's questions about that I can't answer. And there's certain verses that are difficult because of that. But no matter which of these you adopt, there are difficulties. So we just have to be humble and say that this is what we believe, and whatever it is that we believe, and give allowance for others if they may have a different point of view on this. And again, it's not a matter to break fellowship with. Now, as we get into the Olivet Discourse, the Olivet Discourse is found in Matthew 24 and 25. And the reason it's called the Olivet Discourse is because Jesus was up on the Mount of Olives with His disciples, and it was in the last week of His life. This is when He had come to Jerusalem, knowing that He was going to go to the cross late in that week. But He's with His disciples, and what He's doing, you follow the Gospels and you see what He was doing. He would go into Jerusalem during the day and go into the temple area and teach, and people would come to hear Him. A lot of his enemies would come and try to trap Him and trip Him up and that sort of thing. But then He would go back out onto the mountain with His disciples in the evening. And you sort of get the picture. It's probably not exactly like this, but like they were around the campfire and they would ask Him questions. It would give Him a chance to pour into their lives. He knew that He was down to the last few days with those disciples that He had been with for 3.5 years. And you could just kind of sense that the Lord is trying to pour into their lives all that He can right here at the end, before He goes to the cross and knows that He's going to be separate from them. After 40 days after the resurrection, He's going to ascend back to the Father. So here is where the Lord teaches. This is where you will find the Lord teaching about His second coming, is in the Olivet Discourse. If you want to know what Jesus said about it, it's here in the Olivet Discourse. And the outline that we want to use for this, we're going to see the background that is in chapter 24, verses 1 and 2, just the background to this. The question Jesus was asked, you could say questions there, but I'm going to tell you why I just have the word question there. 24, verse 3. The labor pains, or birth pains as they're called, in verses 4 through 8. Christians being hated and martyred for the sake of the gospel. That's in verses 9 through 14. And then the Great Tribulation is talked about. Jesus talks about that in verses 15 through 28. And then the rapture, I think it's a clear reference there to the rapture, in verses 29 through 31. And those alive at the time will be able to know that the time is near. That's a clear statement by Jesus in verses 32 through 35. We won't know the day or the hour. It says in Thessalonians that we can know the season. We can sense the season that we're going into, that the time is short if we're alive at this time. But then the whole after that, after you get through verse 35, from 24, 36, all the way through the end of chapter 25, the one theme, and it takes up the predominant part of this Olivet discourse, far more than these other items that I've listed here, is that we need to just be ready. That's the bottom line, is to be ready for the second coming of Jesus. And so let's look at the background. We're only going to look at a couple of items tonight, about two or three of these portions of this outline. The first one is the background in verses 1 and 2. So let's just read verses 1 and 2. It says, "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, 'Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down.'" And this really, Jesus' response to his disciples there got them to thinking. As they were leaving the temple area to go back out to the Mount of Olives, Jesus has just made a remarkable statement in their minds, because this temple was one of the wonders of the world, the construction of it and the way that it was built. And they would have thought that there is no way that could happen, that the temple would be destroyed like that. But it started them to thinking, and it's what caused them later that evening on the mountain to come to Jesus and begin to ask him some questions about that. But as we look at this Olivet discourse, I just want to make a couple of general statements about it. It's covered in all three of the, it's called the Synoptic Gospels. That's Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And those are the ones who are presenting the life of Christ in a chronological order for the most part. And they're the three Gospels that are, you can usually, if you find a story in one of the Gospels, you'll find it in the other of the other two. John was written not in chronological order, but there were certain themes that John picked out and throughout the book to focus on. And so the Synoptic Gospels, you'll find the Olivet Discourse in all three. Each account has a slightly different emphasis. Mark's emphasis is different than Matthew's. Matthew's is different than Luke. And so there's a slightly different emphasis that you find in each of the Gospels. And when you put them all together, you probably get a good approximate picture of all that Jesus taught them that night about his second coming and about what would happen in Jerusalem in AD 70 and all of those things that would come into play here. And you got to keep this in mind too, that when you have sermons like this in the Bible, you don't have the whole sermon here. These are Jesus probably sat there with those disciples for hours in the evening and talked about these things. And so what we have is the condensed version of what Jesus, no doubt what they talked about that night. And so each of the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, gave slightly different summaries and slightly different emphasis. Nothing contradictory, but just different focus. Matthew's account is the one that's the most comprehensive. It takes up two long chapters in the book of Matthew, and so it's the one that is the most comprehensive of all the three. And then Matthew's account is the one that emphasizes Jesus' teaching about end time events more so than the other two, even though the other two do mention some things about the end times. And so the second thing we want to see is the question that the disciples ask. And so you go to verse 3 to see that. And it says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" And so the question that he was asked there. Now, to really understand the approach that Jesus takes in answering those, what you might say are three questions, is that in the minds of those disciples, it was all one question. if you talk about when the temple would be destroyed and when Jesus would come and what would be the end of the age, in their mind, if the temple got destroyed, that would represent the end of the age. It would be like someone in our day saying, well, when will the nuclear war be, and when will the earth be destroyed, and when will, you know, whatever. And so in it's all in their mind, they're understanding the cataclysmic nature of each of those questions. It's gonna represent the end of the age. And Jesus' answer, this is how you really know that, is that Jesus answered in a way that addressed his immediate disciples who were right there in front of him. He talked to them, no question. He was dealing, and primarily it was Peter, James, and John, and Andrew. You get that understanding in the Gospel of Luke, that they came and got right around him. No doubt the other disciples were back around them too. It was not just them. But he answered them in a way that addressed his immediate disciples. But he also, and there's no way to understand what we're going to study here in Matthew 24 without understanding this, he also looked down through the portals of time to speak to those who would be alive in the last days. In other words, yes, he was talking to his immediate disciples who were there, but he was looking over their shoulder down through time to those disciples that would be alive, and really, really disciples all through the Christian ages, but especially those who would be alive in the last days. There are certain things in the account here in Matthew that can only be explained as being not just what happened in Jerusalem in AD 70, but what would happen at the end of the age. And he uses words that present a sequence of events, especially the word then. He uses that word 11 times. Just glance in these verses. Look in verse 1, very first word of the chapter, then. Look down in verse 9. I've got all of these circled in my Bible. Then they will deliver you up. Verse 14 at the end of the verse, then the end will come. And it goes on like that. So in all of these verses, you'll find that word then. And then is a sequence word. If you say the word then and you're listing things, you say this happened, then this happened. It's showing you the sequence that the things happened. And so that's very important as we study through the rest of this. Now, one final thing here, I think. The disciples may have meant something different when they asked the question, what will be the sign of your coming? A lot of the critics of the post-tribulation view, they say, well, what they were asking is, when will Jesus come on the scene and set up his kingdom? And that may be true. That may be what they had in mind when they asked that question. But that's not how Jesus answered it. Jesus answered it about his second coming. And that's, well, I don't know what I did there. Jesus clearly answered their question in terms of his second coming at the end of the age. There's certain things here, as I've said, that's the only way you can explain it. So he was certainly not talking about when he would set up his kingdom in their lifetime, because he knew that it was not going to be in their lifetime. But the second coming at the end of the age is that's the way he answered their question. Now, this is the last thing we'll look at tonight. In verses 4 through 8, he speaks about labor pains or birth pains. If you look at in verse 8, this is how we get the heading here. He says all of these things that were just mentioned in verses 4 through 8 are the beginning of sorrows. And so Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. Verse 4, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. And that word sorrows is the translation of that is labor pains or birth pains. So here's the list. There will be deception of many false Christs, wars and rumors of wars. We're in the middle of a situation in the world now, aren't we? Nations rising against nations. famines, pestilences. And there, pestilences, they didn't know about microscopic organisms probably in their day, but we know about them today, and you've got these viruses and things like that that are spreading on the earth. And so the days in which we live are really described by pestilences in some ways, famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. I mean, it seems like about once a week you hear about an earthquake somewhere, South America or someplace. And then finally, just to summarize it all, he says, but the end is not yet. All these are the beginning of sorrows. And so what do we know about labor pains? Well, somebody might say, some of the women might say, Brother Paul, you don't know anything about labor pains. But I know I was there when our babies were born, and I love to tell the story about Linda, and I was there doing what I could do. I was just trying to do the best I could do, and she was holding on to something, and I was just stroking her hand. I thought that was a good husbandly thing to do, just kind of rubbing her hand like that. You know, just, darling, I'm here for you, or whatever. And she looked up at me and she said, would you cut that out? And so I'll admit, I don't know a lot about labor pains. But what we do know is that labor pains come prior to the birth. And when they begin, it indicates that the time for the birth is drawing near. And in this sense, it's with ever increasing intensity that the birth draws nearer and nearer. And I think what we've seen even in our lifetime, that, you know, you go back 50 years ago, you saw some of these things that were happening in the world, a nation rising against nation, earthquakes in various places, pestilences, famines, all of these things. But what we are seeing as time goes on is with greater and greater intensity as the time draws near.